Hello and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Denise Hamilton, founder and CEO of Watch Her Work and author of Indivisible, How to Forge Our Differences into a Stronger Future. Denise joins the show today to discuss the book, which comes out February 6th, and how she hopes it inspires current and future leaders to move beyond how they think of diversity and inclusion and to move toward a better, more indivisible world. Denise also shares how integral Houston's diversity has been on her career and creating this book. Denise, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's good to be back in the saddle with you.
I know, it's been 4 years, which is crazy since you've been on the podcast, and we have a lot of catching up to do. And it's an exciting time to talk to you, of course. So before we dive in to your new book, which is coming out soon, let's give our listeners a little background on you. Tell us about Watch Her Work and your career and how kind of you got to this point in your career.
Sure. So I've been an executive for over 25 years before I started Watch Her Work. And in that, throughout the course of that time, I had been very often the only or the first African-American or woman in just about every job I ever had. And so through that process, just learned a lot of lessons about what skills work, what behaviors are not intuitive, and built Watch Her Work, my subsequent company, with the intention of kind of creating a space that people could get all of that advice, all of that juicy goodness, so they could learn what they needed to do to be authentically successful. And, you know, that was an exciting project. We had over, I think at the peak, 12,000 videos of women from all walks of life sharing their best advice. And of course, that led to me being brought in different organizations to be a speaker, and ultimately has led to me now being an author, which is so exciting. My book, Indivisible, How to Forge Our Differences into a Stronger Future, is hitting the world. It's always shocking when people want to listen to what you have to say. It's unbelievable. And so it's a really exciting time.
Yeah, I think it's such a natural progression too. I'm so proud of you for like kind of reaching this author milestone too. And the description of the book is so fascinating and I think so timely. So I want to dive into that. Part of the description I'll just read because I'm not even going to summarize. It's great. So you're challenging readers to move beyond current notions of diversity and inclusion to build communities, workplaces, and relationships that live up to that world. And I think what's so fascinating about that is we've talked about DEI initiatives. And it's like anything in the world, it needs to be iterated on and kind of, as we learn more, change how we approach things. So for you, what's the key message you're hoping people take away from the book?
Yeah, I think that DEI, they're a set of tools, they're a set of practices, right? And there's always room for growth and innovation. But there's not any desire, there shouldn't be at least any desire to go backwards, right? You can say, you know, I'm really struggling with the changes that DEI policies are requesting. And you can say, I think DEI is taking us from 0 to 3, and I have an idea to take us from 0 to 7. But you can't just say, this is too hard, let's go back to 0, right? So I think it's really important to have a commitment to addressing the challenges. And I actually see them as opportunities, right? I want to be authentically indivisible. I want every person to have room for their giftedness to shine, for their capabilities to be able to be added to this soup that we call this country, right? And so, and we see that. I know you talk a lot about tech and innovation and the idea that only certain people are allowed access to these spaces of creativity, it cheats us all. You know, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I have a firm belief that the cure for cancer has already been born. They were just born in the wrong neighborhood. And that means we didn't hear it. We didn't receive it. We didn't get that, the benefit of that giftedness. So I think the work that we have before us, quite honestly, is to reconnect to the bigger goal. The goal is not a Noah's Ark, two of each kind on the boardroom. Like, those are tools, those are tactics. The goal is to be indivisible. It's to have a space that if you have a set of skills that you have to contribute, you have a way to contribute them, and you are not limited or restricted because of any particular difference. And that's a lofty goal. It's challenging. And the way I would distinguish between the actual objective and the tactics, it's like having, being healthy is different than wanting to be thin. There are multiple ways to be thin, including a lot of unhealthy ones, right? But if your goal is to have a healthy body, then your behaviors kind of roll up differently. And there's a whole set of behaviors you won't engage in because they're not healthy. So I think sometimes when we talk about DEI, we insert like artificial metrics because they're low-hanging fruit and easy to reach, right? It's easy to say, oh, we're going to do this mentorship program, or we're going to do events around different special holidays, or we're going to do recruiting at different colleges. These are all great ideas, but the rubber hits the road. You can do all of those things, but if you don't address toxic behavior in your organization, none of those things really matter, right? I always compare it to motherhood. Let's say I was going to grade motherhood, right? You feed your child, you have a roof over their head, they have clean clothes, and you pick five metrics that you're going to use to say you're a good mother. Well, guess what? You can do all five of those things and do them well. But if you beat your child half to death every night, you are not a good mother. And so we have to be careful that we don't use easy metrics to determine if we're being authentically successful. This is hard work, and it's okay to have challenging, higher level goals that push us to do better and be better, and to resist the temptation of lesser goals.
I love all of these analogies because I feel like it's really speaking to me to just covering, and we're going to talk about it later, but like covering the Houston innovation ecosystem and all of the following the metrics is not telling the full story. And so that's like, it's really speaking to me. And I think the difference is we're talking about people. People aren't numbers, just, you know, yeah, it's a fact. So it's hard to really all encompass and cover that with just a couple metrics, as you described. So I wonder, what was this moment where you decided you were going to write this book, and when you decided what all you were going to kind of include, and how did you map that out?
Well, it's an incredible story. It's a tech story, as so many stories are. I was on Clubhouse and got an opportunity to interact with Adam Grant around his book, Think Again. And we had some beautiful conversations. And he's actually who pushed me to write the book. He was like, you need to write a book. And so so I did, you know, and really I tried to just capture all the observations that I've seen, all the things that I've seen people do that was counterintuitive or ineffective. And really, if you know anything about my work, I'm very low on jargon. I don't do a lot of language that is easily misunderstood, right? Because I think even if you stop 100 people on the street right now and ask them what DEI means, the definitions would be all over the place. I think that happens for a couple reasons. I think there are people who are committed to not understanding, right? Like, it's easier for them to make it complicated and obtuse than it is to just keep it simple. But also I think that I want to be, my word of the year actually is effective. And the more clearly I can communicate with someone, the more simple my terms, the more clear our communication is, the better chance we have of getting to some kind of consensus. So, you know, language is polarizing. It can be really triggering. If I hooked you up to a blood pressure machine right now and said, you know, evangelical Christian, thin blue line, me, hashtag me too, Black Lives Matter, all lives matter, like your blood pressure would literally start to go up because all of these terms have become so charged in our society. And so if my ultimate goal is to seek connection, I don't want to trigger you. I want to keep the examples and the language as simple and as clear as possible so that you can see my position, and I hope, you know, we'll consider it. So I think there's a lot of ways that we can be more effective in the ways we connect with each other. And it takes some effort to do that, but I really believe that the work is worth it. We have to learn how to disagree without destruction. We just have to. We've gotten to a space where we use humiliation as a tool, and we think that's going to convince somebody. And we've all seen the clips, you know, they stick the mic in somebody's face and ask them a question that makes them look like an idiot. And we all laugh and share those memes. Ha 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 ha. Isn't it funny? But I've never seen anyone brought to your position because you humiliated them. It's mean, and we need to rethink, reconsider how we communicate with each other. So when I started writing the book and this idea of being indivisible, it meant to me, like, what happens to you happens to me. Like, we're all in the same boat. I can't sit in my part of the boat laughing at you because there's a hole at your end of the boat. We're all going to sink, right? If that, we're all going to go down. And so I need to care about you. You need to care about me. And I have a new rule. If you say you love America, you're probably going to have to try to love Americans. And that means sometimes harnessing a little bit more patience, a little bit more understanding, and making a bigger effort to communicate effectively. And in Houston, we're like experts at this, like, you know, one of the most diverse cities in the country, right? Like we are always growing and pushing in the ways that we interact with each other and learn from each other. And so maybe in a small way, this is the perfect petri dish for my book to be born.
It's so true. And I think so much of what you just said just resonated. And I have kind of like a two-part question. The first is, everything you're talking about is very of this time. And, you know, it's been a lot these past few years. A lot has happened. A lot has changed. A lot of this animosity and this tension has happened over these past few years. How much of the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement, how much of this has influenced the book? And then the second part of that question is, how do you, you know, sit down and crank out a book that's going to, you don't have a crystal ball. So how are you, you know, feeling about your book standing the test of time? I mean, I think that's a tough challenge.
It is. I really tried to make it not a current events book. It's not a current events book. It's a people book. It's lots of examples that are really simple and easy to understand and timeless. You know, I think those are the ways we kind of get a principle, and then we can extrapolate it to the current event, the you know, the storm of the day. George Floyd's murder was catalytic in so many ways. And it's been really interesting watching over the last few years, kind of how the pendulum has swung back. It's almost like, I don't know, like you had some glasses on that didn't allow you to see the color blue. And George Floyd's murder knocked the glasses off for a lot of people. And now they can see blue. And wait, oh, there's blue in healthcare. Oh, there's blue in education. There's blue in the prison system. Like, there's a lot of blue. And some people are tempted to just scramble to find the glasses to put them back on, right? Or like, let's go back to normal. This is too divisive. The language that people use is they want to go back to a time that they didn't know, right? And the truth is, like, we can't, we have to resist the temptation to go back to a time we didn't know. This is a time that we have to struggle through some of these changes, but I promise it'll be good in the end. And how can I be so sure of that? Because we've done this before. We've done it time and time and time again. We've had practices or behaviors that were abhorrent or inappropriate or cruel, and we found a way to move past them. I always say it's really funny that we block the telling of some of these stories when we really need to be cracking open those books and reading those stories, because they to me give me hope that we can move beyond even the most horrific of situations. And so there's an optimism that I elect to move through the world with, that I think we all have to tap into. I think the only people that can change the world are the ones who think they can, right? And so the energy of this time feeling so dire and feeling so complex, we've had so many complex seasons in our history, and we need to learn from those and take power and strength in the fact that we overcame them then, and we can overcome this now. We just have to dial back in. And part of this for me is, and I talk about this in the book at length, actually, we have to move like owners, not renters, right? And what is the difference in my mind? An owner does all the unsexy things. They fix the foundation, they fix the plumbing, the electrical stuff nobody sees or nobody ever is even connected to. Why? Because they're connected to the long-term viability of the property. Renters use peel and stick tile, right? They're just here for a moment. And we can't move through this space, this that we all live on, this rock that we all live on. We can't move through it like renters, like someone else is coming. No, you're waiting on the Messiah, and the Messiah is waiting on you. So, what would happen? How would we be different if we saw this space as our space to care for and to nurture? And we saw our fellow citizens as ours, as part of our interconnectedness and the key to whether or not we succeed or fail. I think we would move differently. I'm pretty sure we wouldn't be arguing about giving lunch to school children. There's some stuff we just wouldn't ever argue about if we moved through this space with a shared sense of our interconnectedness. And so I hope that this book can remind people of that we only move forward together.
It's such a great point to say that the tension and this like split and divide has happened, and it's happened before, which is the point you made. And I think that the big difference is we have, and it's kind of positive if you think about it, we have so much more transparency and connection to people within the country and also globally, that just like the pace is so fast of information traveling. And it's great that we have access to more information and people aren't living in the dark of what's actually happening as much, but it's put a challenge into this reaction with people. I don't know. Sorry. That when you talked about that, I was like, it's so true that the country has always been a, you know, divided. We've always had two political parties, but why is it so tense now? And it's because there's just a lot of information, a lot of misinformation, that access has been increased.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of information, the sheer volume of information that we don't have the capacity to even sift through. We're trying to out-compute computers instead of trying to out-human computer. You know what I mean? Like it's a weird posture that we're in of so much information. And I don't even know from evolutionary like level, are our brains set up to process the trauma of the entire world? The way we get a constant deluge of information. And what has happened is we have, what's led to is this feeling of helplessness. The world is so big, there's so much happening. What can I possibly do? And I find that particularly ironic because here are the most powerful people in the world who have talked themselves into a stage of helplessness that is inappropriate. right? And the person, I have a personal historical muse, my hero, and that's Harriet Tubman. And you think about somebody like Harriet Tubman who couldn't read, couldn't write, didn't have a map, didn't have a horse, didn't know anybody in the North, didn't, here's this enslaved woman who ran by herself. Even she had a disability. There were so many reasons that she should not have done it. She ran by herself from the South to the North to secure her freedom. That in and of itself is amazing. Then she turned around and came back and got other people. Mind blown. I can't really imagine doing that, right? And sometimes she did, she made multiple trips, and sometimes she got as few as three people. We get so discouraged because we can't just add water and get, you know, an instant solution. We want a 10-second solution for a 10-generation problem. And here is this person that went back time and time and time again to save people. And I think the final number was about 70 people. And I have to, it makes me ask myself, and makes me ask those around me, do we have less assets than Harriet Tubman did? Do we have less abilities, less giftedness, less skills, less resources? No, we don't. So how, it's almost rude, it's almost disrespectful to move through the world with a lens of helplessness. Like, how dare you? You have so much. So how can we get out of this conversation of smallness? And, you know, I want to be fair. This is my gracious moment. There are people who are enriched by our outrage and by our division, quite frankly. They make money off of the fight. You know, there's not a lot of money in peace and harmony. And so we have to resist the environment that we're sitting in that tells us we are diametrically opposed on every single issue. I just don't think that's true. So we have to resist that and find our power, our individual power to do something where we are. I imagine kind of all of us being in a stadium. If everybody dropped a couple pieces of paper at your feet, that stadium is trashed, absolutely trashed. But the opposite is just as true. What if everybody bent down and picked up the trash around their feet? What does it look like then? So I think this idea of like waiting for somebody else to come and save us is crippling us. We are so capable, so powerful, so smart, so educated, so well-resourced that what we've got to do is figure out what are the ways that I personally in my life can create impact and difference. What can I do? And there's so much that we can do, and we can't let the world talk us out of our individual power.
Yeah, I mean, it always feels cheesy to hear that, you know, each person makes a difference, but it's a great reminder that if everyone is told that and everyone believes that, then it does. And even if it's just the majority, like maybe it's we can't get everybody.
Or a minority, like, it's always been a few people that shaped change. It's never been everyone. Average is a word for a reason. Average, regular, normal people love a status quo, right? We love the frameworks that make our lives make sense and keep everything simple and predictable. But it's always been a smaller group that said, let's go for it. Let's do it. Let's try something new. Let's innovate. Let's create. And we need to tap into that group. And that group needs to tap into its power.
Well, I could go off on a tangent and continue talking about all of this, but I want to bring it back to the book. Did you have a specific reader you were writing to, and did that change over time? Who should read the book is the question overall.
You know, if you lead or influence people, you should read this book. And I think that occurs in the boardroom. That occurs in a startup, that occurs in the PTA, right? Or the little league coach. Like, if you lead people, you should read this book. This is a book about human nature and about the ways that we can access our power to be impactful. So, if you have a desire to be effective in your relationships with other people, this is the book for you. So people ask me, is there like a demographic target? No, it's people who, and I believe there are a lot of them. It's people who want to make this work. People who believe in this grand American experiment and are ready to take responsibility for our generation's chapter of the story. Those are the people that should read this book.
For your writing process, what sort of influences did you have? What sort of like homework did you have to do?
Ooh. Well, first, like I said earlier, I didn't want this to be a current events book. I wanted it to be a book of principles, of concepts. So I had to do a lot of research. I went back to find a lot of old stories, a lot of stories that people think they know that weren't true. So there's a lot of that in the book of debunking. So a lot of kind of reflecting on the experiences that I had had and extracting the lessons from them. And then also taking advantage of this incredible time that we live in, that we have access to all of these little known stories. What lessons do they have for us? So it was a lot of research and a lot of discussions with people about what's working and what's not working, what they're afraid of, what they're scared of, what they're excited about. And in the book, there is a thread of that ridiculous optimism. And I'd sought out good news, good stories of success and possibility, because I don't think we get enough of those in our day to day.
I love that. So this is your first book. I know you've published a journal before, right? So what do you wish you had known before starting this book that you know now after finishing it?
Oh boy. I wish I had known that it's not that serious. I think that a book, one of the hardest things about a book is it's frozen in time. Like this book is done. I'm holding it in my hand right now. I can't change it. I mean, I could do a second edition or updated version 10 years from now, but for now, it is what it is. And that was really challenging for me because one of my superpowers is being tapped into the current feelings, the current energies, and knowing how to, flex and bend within them. And I couldn't do that on this book. On this book, you have to, on any book, you have to like commit to the written word that is stops and becomes a moment in time. And so that has the potential to kind of get in your head and make you overthink rather than just sharing from your heart, sharing what it is you want people to know. And so people have asked me a lot, I want to write a book and where do I start? And I just say, start. Don't write a book, write a page. Don't write a framework. Just write down a concept and just start and just collect it. And then you start organizing it and you're going to blink and you have a book. It was very intimidating. Like, how many words can I don't think I have this many words. I've never read this many words in my life, but after a while, we're like editing and cutting things out because we were too long. Like you have so much inside of you, right? I think a book is a great project. I really believe everyone should do it at least once because you just learn as much about yourself as you learn about the subject matter.
I think, as you probably saw from my earlier questions, that is something I really appreciate from an author and especially a nonfiction. Because, like, I'm a big fiction reader. It doesn't matter. Like, the times aren't going to change. I mean, the reader might change, but the story is set in this time and it doesn't matter that time moves on in the real world. But it's such a challenge to think of, like, how do you write this book that's going to resonate today, tomorrow, next year? And so, you going back to you talking about it's a people book. Like, at our core, people aren't changing crazily. Like, the world around us is changing and we're interacting in it differently. But that being said, do you have a second book in you down the road?
Once I get over the trauma, that was this one. Yeah, I mean, I definitely have a few ideas that I'm working on now. And the idea of being like a regular contributor to the discussions of our lives is just, it's really exciting. And I will say it's an honor, right? Especially for as a Black woman, there are not a lot of traditionally published nonfiction books, especially in the business area, that are, you know, traditionally published by Black women. And so I count it as an incredible honor and an incredible like statement of progress that I get to write one book, let alone two or three or four. So I couldn't squander that opportunity. My mother wouldn't let me.
Yeah, everyone should go to the bookstore and look at the business section and the back covers. It's you won't find a woman until you're like, I don't know, 10, 15 books deep.
Well, so. and it's really interesting too, who they put in self-help and who they put in business and who they put in personal development. It's very interesting. If a man writes the book, it goes in the business section, no matter what it's about. But if the woman writes the book, it goes into self-help or personal growth. It's really interesting. Here's a space that needs to be disrupted as well. Maybe we'll have to do that. We'll tackle that on the next podcast, the disruption of the publishing industry.
Oh my gosh, I have so many thoughts. I have a little bit of a background in the book publishing world. So I have lots of thoughts. So on February, what you're saying is on February 6th, we should go to a bookstore, find your stack of books and move them from wherever they are into business. So yes. That's our mandate. So we love talking about Houston. So I want to wrap up the conversation with that. And you've already touched on this, that Houston is a really great place for this thought leadership to happen because we're such a diverse city and a very big business city. And you can kind of make that argument about Texas in general too, but what specifically about Houston, how do you see Houston's role in your career and specifically this book?
Yeah, I think it's really easy to talk about diversity in a vacuum, like theoretically, and Houston lives it every single day, you know, whether it's the food scene, whether it's our professional environments, whether it's our neighborhoods, like how do you reconcile different animating issues with different populations in a geographical area? We're doing it while other people are talking about it. And so I think there are some great lessons to be learned from this environment, and there are some opportunities here that we still have, you know, the opportunity to take advantage of here in Houston. So I'm excited to be here. People, I do get a hard time. I won't lie. People say like, are you going to stay in Houston? Are you moving to New York? Are you moving to LA? Are you, you know, what's next for you? And I have no plans to leave because I think in a lot of ways, this is the front line, right? These are the places where difference really manifests itself in a way that, and with a group of people that are committed to navigating it, right? Like it's easy to just have a Black neighborhood here and a white neighborhood there and an Asian neighborhood there. And we can do that. But that's not what we're doing. We're all at our favorite restaurant. We're all at Papacito's eating at the same time and loving those beef fajita nachos. But I think it's a really great space to test out the very things that I purport in my book. And it's the place that taught me some of those lessons. So I'm here. I'm a Houstonian. And I really appreciate the gift of this space. And I'm excited to see what we do next. And I hope we do better, right? Because that's the goal, right? I almost called my book Better. That was the working title for a while. Because it was like, that's to me, that's the ultimate goal. It's like Atomic Habits, where he says just like, it's just a little bit of improvement every day. And you are head and shoulders above everyone else. And so that's how I choose to kind of live my life. How can we be a little bit better every day? And that's what I see the efforts of here in Houston.
I am glad to hear that because I personally am so proud that Houston can claim you. And obviously the world needs you, but the book can go to the world and then people can come to Houston and see it in actuality, but
Yes. Me and Brené Brown, we're squatters. We're Houston squatters.
I love that she's from here too. Anytime anyone talks about loving Brené Brown, I'm like, did you know she's from Houston? That is my my contribution. But yeah, no, thank you so much for joining me, and congrats on the book. And yeah, it's our mandate on February 6th. Go find the book, move it to the business section, and then take a copy home with you, right?
Absolutely. And support your local bookstores or independent bookstores. We need them.
Absolutely. Thanks, Denise.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.